This week, we break into the long, sordid history of Freemasonry in the first of a multi-part series. Freemasonry and the Ancient Mysteries. What were they like? Then, we move into the various hurdles the craft has faced throughout the ages. Everyone seems to know a bit about Leo Taxil and his Masonic rantings, leading to rampant anti-Masonry around the world. But what did the text of Gabriel Jagon pages really say? And finally, illustrious Brother Harrison stops by to give us an account of the last casualty in the Civil War, who just happens to be a Master Mason. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back. This is episode number 458. This is the first in a series of episodes that will be reading through a longer Masonic research paper that truly spans the ages. Originally published in the Lion's Paw Club in 1913, The Story of Freemasonry Part 1 is the name of this episode. So what we're going to attempt to do over the next several episodes is break this long piece down into manageable chunks for all of you, and it is broken into parts that really dive into a lot of the history here. Now, I have not read this in advance. It seemed like a really interesting read, and for the most part, everything that I've found in a lot of these older magazines tends to be pretty good. There may be some historical inaccuracies or contextual inaccuracies, as is the case usually when we are reading some of the older works, and not to say that our older scholars and storytellers are purposefully misdirecting anybody. It's just that likely a lot of the information contained within some of this is or was not available to them at the time of writing. So we'll start off with part one here in just a few minutes, but first I want to go ahead and thank all of our producers, our fellows, our contributors. Thank you guys so much for helping us produce this program, and for everybody else out there helping the Whence Came You podcast out through the various ways you can help support this show. Head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show to see how you can help in our production of a Sonic Education. Also, I want to go ahead and take just a moment here to let everybody know, if you head on over to MasonicConChicago.com, people have asked a lot of questions, and we've released some information recently. I'm not sure everybody out there is up to speed on what's going on with Masonic on Chicago. So here's the gist. We have COVID-19. We're not pushing the event back at all. So Chicago Masonic Con is going to happen on September 18th, 19th, and 20th. We have a more up-to-date schedule about to be released here in the coming weeks. I'm just wrapping up some last-minute edits to the schedule. Now, due to state regulations, we are unable to continue to allow people to buy tickets for an in-person event. So what that means is those who have already purchased general admission or an executive pass are welcome to come, and it's going to be pretty amazing. What we are offering now for everybody else at a reduced cost, but still equitable to everybody else, is what we're calling the Executive Digital Pass. Your executive digital pass is really designed to meet the challenges of COVID-19 and those who can't travel. So this pass is going to include all access to the presentations via secure links. We're going to use a webinar format. You're going to get a coupon for shopping with our vendors, a subscription to the Rocky Mountain Mason magazine. You're going to get the coin, a lapel pin, and a badge, which will be physically mailed to you. This is a really great deal for you. Those tickets are on sale right now, and there is no limit to how many of those tickets we can sell. So, of course, again, if you head on over to MasonicCon Chicago and you scroll down, you'll see where you can get that Executive Digital Pass. You'll see a little bit about the token we've designed, the pin that we've designed, and, of course, the Rocky Mountain Mason magazine. What's so key about getting a subscription to a magazine? You might think that's weird, but here's the market differentiator. You know, Masonic education is huge, and while we try to bring this show to you every single week, we can't bring you everything that's amazing. How can we continue to bring you edifying content throughout the year? And the answer is the Rocky Mountain Mason magazine. We've partnered up with Laughing Lion Publications, Ben Williams, who's been so kind to us and has offered us to be able to bring you all a subscription, those executive pass holders and the executive digital pass holders, a subscription to the Rocky Mountain Mason magazine. And that cost is totally built in, totally free for a whole year. It contains articles of interest to Freemasons in general, as well as Masonic history, philosophy, esoterica, and even current events. So if you're interested in that magazine, but you did not purchase an executive digital pass or an executive pass, please check out their website, rockymountainmason.com. There's a new podcast as well. I was lucky enough to be a guest on Ben's podcast recently, and we had just a really great time. So that said, all that is available on MasonicConChicago.com. I want to thank all of the folks who have been with us since the beginning as sponsors and vendors as we've navigated these waters of 2020. Now, if you are planning on physically traveling in for the event, I do want to remind you that you need to be checking all of any travel restrictions that you have, maybe perhaps coming into the Illinois area. While we are Chicago MasonicCon, we are not, I repeat, not in Chicago proper or in Cook County. We will be in Lake County, Illinois. So you'll fly into Chicago or you'll travel through Chicago and you'll come into Lake County. We're about an hour north of Chicago. Better parking, better climate, a little more spread out in a kind of nice old town Libertyville community. So again, thank you so much to everybody. Please head on over to the website, check it out, get your tickets now because there's only about 40 days or so left before the actual event, and you'll help us out by getting your tickets sooner than later. All right, on to The Story of Freemasonry by W.G. Sibley from the Lion's Paw Club, 1913, Part 1, The Initiation into the Ancient Persian Magi and a Curious Legend of Hiram Abiff, Solomon, and the Queen of Sheba. Thousands of years ago, there was a wonderful secret organization in Persia whose underground quarters and equipment for the ceremonial admission of men who sought membership in it were on so large a scale and involved so much time, thought, skill, and expense that it compared with the most elaborate and costly spectacular productions on the modern stage seemed paltry. A man applied for initiation into this society. To test his sincerity and fitness, he was subjected to a period of probation which continued through several months and was undergone in utter solitude in the silence and darkness of a subterranean cave. This ordeal had dethroned the reason of more than one who had undertaken it and was concluded with a fast of 50 days duration. This is what happened to the candidate when finally admitted to the mysteries. He was led by a grotesque figure to a dangerous precipice, from which he felt his way to the deep interior of a gloomy cavern, where he was confronted by a hideous object, which directed him toward a place whence came the howls of ravenous wild beasts. Suddenly seized by unseen hands, he was thrust into the faintly lighted den of animals and instantly attacked by what seemed to be lions, tigers, wolves, and other vicious beasts. But were in fact members of the society, cunningly made up to resemble them. Through this horrible place, he had been directed to make his way, and was tossed, pulled, trampled upon, and buffeted before he escaped, covered with bruises and genuine wounds, into another cavern in which resounded loud peals of thunder, and through which shot constantly terrifying bursts of flame. If he fainted from exhaustion, horror, his senses returned, in a comfortable chamber where delightful music and soothing performances quieted to some extent his agitation. Then, three venerable priests approached him. One of them threw a squirming snake into his bosom, and, with a loathsome reptile chilling his skin, he was conducted to a door from which issued awful cries of lamentation and despair. He beheld a dreadful representation of men enduring the torments of hell. This was followed by seven subterranean journeys into the scenes of as many appalling perils, each likely to disturb the stoutest heart and arouse the most trying emotions. Then, if his strength held out, he entered the Holy of Holies. It was a splendid apartment in which a brilliant sun and beautiful stars moved in a miniature sky, while most ravishing music was heard. In the east, seated upon a golden throne, was a presence before whom the candidate bowed and took the oath of the order. Such was the initiation of both the Persian Magi, the society founded by Zoroaster, whose extreme antiquity is certified by both Aristotle and Plato. There were other mysteries in other lands. In the times of antiquity, those of Isis in Egypt, of Kabiri in Phoenicia, and Sabazian in Rome, and the Eleusinian in Greece. And from among them all, Freemasonry alone has emerged as a living influence on modern civilized society, and is richest in legend, tradition, and historic facts. One very curious tale is told by an English author and student of antiquities whose description of the initiation of the Persian Magi has already been rehearsed. It is a legend of Hiram Abiff, the master architect and engineer at the building of King Solomon's temple, who, according to tradition, assisted Solomon in founding the Masonic Order. When the Queen of Sheba visited Solomon, that prince of riches and glory, who had an appreciative eye for beauty in women, as well as in architecture, fell a victim to the seductive charms of his visitor and sought her hand in marriage. After consideration, she accepted the proposal. Later, when repeated requests had secured the presentation to her of Hiram Abiff, whose work on the temple was a revelation to her of his extraordinary ability, the son of the tribe of Naphtali cast a look into her eyes which drew her heart to him. Solomon, wise in the ways of women, instantly became aware of the impression made by the queen, by his great architect, and was stirred by jealousy. Chagrined, he set about to destroy his friend. The queen met Hiram in a grove near Jerusalem, when none but her maids were present. He was silent and thoughtful, but soon declared his love. She threw herself into his arms, their lips met, and she rapturously responded to his words of affection. Realizing that Solomon would not approve of their marrying, they planned to leave Jerusalem at different times and meet in Arabia. Meanwhile, Solomon had hinted to certain workmen on the temple that Hiram's death would be pleasing to him, and gave them an excuse for quarreling with him. As a consequence, Hiram was slain while seeking exit from the temple. This legend is so at variance with Masonic tradition and history that it cannot be accepted, although it gives additional interest to a biblical character whose memory will live as long as Freemasonry exists among men. It is printed as a curious specimen chosen from among many apocryphal tales which found their way into print in Europe during the 18th century and were widely circulated among readers of books. Part 2. Attempts to exterminate Freemasonry. Freemasonry has at different times been attacked by vigorous and malicious enemies whose purpose was deadly. Many efforts have been made by church and state in European countries to suppress and destroy it. A notable anti-Masonic popular excitement once arose and flourished in the United States, and the closing years of the 19th century witnessed in France a remarkable mystification of the enemies of the fraternity. Half a dozen serious attempts to annihilate the order were made when its purposes were not so clearly understood as they are now, and before the Roman Catholic Church, its most inveterate enemy, began openly and actively its unrelenting warfare against it. An act of Parliament in 1429 made felons of all Masons who confederated in chapters and subjugated them to punishment by imprisonment and fines, but it was never enforced. In 1561, Queen Elizabeth ordered the Grand Lodge of England broken up and forbade Masons to meet in their lodges, but the initiation of a number of her officers into the order and their subsequent importunities to her induced her to withdraw the obnoxious command. France passed a law abolishing Masonry in 1637, owing to a suspicion that it might be dangerous to the government, but public opinion nullified it. The Empress Maria Theresa of Germany was influenced against Masonry in 1747 by ladies of her court who had been unable to cajole or extort its secrets from their husbands, and issued an order that Masons should be arrested while engaging in their lodge work. But the Emperor Joseph I, who was a member of the fraternity, persuaded the misled woman to give up her foolish project, to the intense disappointment and chagrin of the court ladies, whose husbands perhaps had read LaFontaine's sage observation that, quote, "Nothing is so oppressive as a secret. Women find it difficult to keep one," end quote. The Great Council of Bern in Switzerland, a Protestant tribunal, denounced Masonry in 1745, decreeing that, quote, "Citizens and subjects who are actually known to be Freemasons shall be obliged immediately to abjure, by oath, the engagements they have taken and renounce the order voluntarily, should be heavily fined and made ineligible for any employment in the Republic." Owing to the hostile action of the Synod at Stirling in 1745, and the Synod at Edinburgh, 1755, the Associate of Scotland in 1757 ordered Masons to be questioned as to whether, on initiation, they were required to give up all metal on their persons, if the Bible was used in their superstitious ceremonies, and if the passage in 1 Kings 7 through 21 was read to them. All who refused to answer were, quote-unquote, reputed under scandal, and declared, quote, "incapable of admission to sealing ordinances," end quote. Those who did not answer were purged by rebuke and admonition, and strictly charged not to entice others into the snare of Freemasonry. Frederick I of Sweden forbade Freemasonry in his dominions in 1740 under penalty of death, following the example of King Frederick Augustus III of Poland the year before. In 1751, Charles III of Spain prohibited Masonic rites in Naples. A Venice lodge was abolished by the transportation of its members, and in 1818, John VI issued a prohibitory edict from Brazil. During the latter part of the 18th century, Freemasonry was attacked in England both by ridicule and by clerical utterances. At that time, the fraternity's dignity and serious character were in marked contrast to the frivolity of numerous other social societies in that country, which were almost without exception bibulous bodies and generally envious of Freemasonry. The members of these convivial organizations, of which the song, the glass, and the racy anecdote were the essence, delighted in deriding and satirizing Freemasons. One of the numerous rhymes of the period describing them as a, quote, "a set of ranting, roaring, rumbling fellows who meet to sing Old Rose and Burn the Bellows. Champagne and claret, dozens in a jerk, and then they saw how hard they've been at work. Next, for the secret of their own wise-making, Hiram and Boaz and Grandmaster Jakin, poker and tongs, the sign, the word, the stroke, 'tis all nothing, and 'tis all a joke," end quote. They were also charged with practicing black arts, such as raising the devil in a circle and branding initiates with a red-hot poker. Several books were printed to prove the truth of similar foolish stories, and one of them was seriously entitled Masonry: The Way to Hell, a sermon wherein it is clearly proved both from reason and from scripture that all who profess the mysteries are in a state of damnation. The 100 years preceding 1793 were prolific in amusing publications that professed to be exposures of Freemasonry, written by French and English romancers. No less than 45 of these productions are to be found in Masonic libraries, where they are preserved as curiosities. They bear such titles as An Account of the Freemasons, The Grand Mystery of Freemasons Discovered, Masonry Dissected, The Secrets of Masonry Made Known, A Master Key to Freemasonry, The Three Distinct Knocks, The Freemason Stripped Naked, Freemasonry of the Ladies, and The Veil Withdrawn. The Roman Catholic Church viewed Freemasonry with deep suspicion when it first began to spread over Europe as a confessedly oath-bound secret organization. When it learned that Masons would not reveal their secrets in the confessional, and that their society taught freedom of conscience and other tolerant and liberal principles, the suspicion settled into a deep-seated hatred, which was augmented from time to time by the undoubted participation of French and Italian lodges in political adventures inimical to the temporal power of the Pope. The Roman Church had sufficient influence to cause the promulgation of a government edict for the abolishment of Masonry in Holland in 1735. An Amsterdam lodge defied the order and continued to meet secretly. They were discovered and arrested in their lodge, acknowledged that they were Masons, swore that their society taught nothing repugnant to the laws of God or man, submitted a proposition that the court before which they were brought should select some man in whom it had implicit confidence for initiation, and they would abide by his judgment. This was done. The town clerk became a Mason and so strongly approved the teachings of the fraternity that the magistrate himself applied for admission and was accepted, to his great satisfaction. Pope Clement VII issued a bull in 1738, the first of a series of papal fulminations in which he denounced Freemasonry because it admitted to its altars men of all religions and imposed obligations its members would not reveal at the confessional. The following year, he published an edict threatening all who visited lodges with a fine of 1,000 crowns of gold and the torture of the rack. Under this vicious decree, in Spain and Portugal, several Masons were imprisoned and tortured by the Inquisition, which first sought to extort from them the secrets of the society by the infliction of inhumane torments, and failing to accomplish that purpose, sent them to the galleys, on which they were subjected to the most offensive indignities and frightful cruelties. One Freemason, John Custos, lived to tell the story of this suffering from the Inquisition at Lisbon in Portugal. He was a native of Switzerland whose parents took him to England in 1716. A lapidary by profession, after 22 years, residence in London and 5 in Paris, he went to Lisbon to work on precious stones. There, in various private house, he practiced Freemasonry with his brethren. And an inquisitive woman, at confession, told of the meetings. The priest informed the Inquisition, which seized him in March 1743, and threw him into a dungeon, where he was forbidden to speak and could hear nothing but the groans and dismal cries of other prisoners. A few days later, he was led to the Inquisition and charged with speaking injuriously of the Roman religion, which he denied, and then replaced in his dungeon for reflection. 3 days later, he was again before them and was requested to explain the nature of Freemasonry, which he did so as far as consistent with his obligations. Then he was taken to another and deeper dungeon where he laid in darkness 7 weeks, during which he was taken before the Inquisitors 3 times. The first time they insisted that he should reveal the secrets of the order, which he declined to do. The second time they threatened him, called him a heretic, and said he was damned, after advising him to turn Roman Catholic before it was all too late. The last time, after arguing manfully for his rights, he was doomed to suffer the tortures of the Holy Office for not revealing the secrets of Masonry. He was stripped naked, except for his drawers. An iron collar fastened to a scaffold was put around his neck, a ring fixed to each foot, and his limbs tightly stretched. Small ropes were wound around his arms and thighs, passed through the holes under the scaffold and drawn tight by 4 men. These ropes cut into the flesh, to the bone in several places. 4 times, Custos refused to reveal the secrets, and at each refusal, the utmost strength of his tortures was applied to the ropes, his judges declaring that his obstinacy would make him guilty of self-murder. 6 weeks later, when his wounds were partially recovered, he was again conducted to the Chamber of Horrors, when his arms were slowly drawn backward by an engine until his shoulders were dislocated and blood came from his mouth. This hellish torture was inflicted 3 times, when he was returned to his cell and rough physicians reduced the dislocations. In 2 months, he was again taken to the torture room. This time, a heavy iron chain was wrapped twice around his arms and body, terminating at the wrist. The ends of the chain were attached to ropes running through pulleys, which, when stretched, pressed and bruised his body and put his wrists and shoulders out of joint. 2 times in 1 day, he was subjected to this torture. 4 weeks after he was still unable to lift hand to his mouth, his body was frightfully swollen, and he suffered such dreadful anguish as may not be imagined. He was then condemned to be a galley slave for 4 years. There, the friars of the convent of Corpo Santos offered him release if he would turn Roman Catholic, but his stout Swiss heart would not consent. Word of his condition reaching his brother-in-law, that relative was able to interest the Duke of Newcastle in the case, and finally King George II, through the British minister Compton at Lisbon, demanded and secured his release as a British subject in October of 1744, and he arrived in London December 15th of the same year, where he wrote a detailed account of his sufferings. Papal constitutions, edicts, epistles, allocutions, and encyclicals of varying degrees of harshness were issued against the order by Clement XII in 1738, by Benedict XIV in 1751, by Pius VII in 1814, by Leo XII in 1825, by Pius VIII in 1829, by Gregory XVI in 1832, by Pius IX in 1846, 1865, 1869, and 1873, and by Leo XIII in 1884, 1890, and 1892. The papal allocution of 1865 pronounces Freemasonry as quote-unquote monstrous, impious, and criminal, full of snares and frauds, a dark society, the enemy of the Church of God, and dangerous to the security of kingdoms, inflamed with a burning hatred against religions and legitimate authority, and desirous of overthrowing all rights, human and divine, end quote. The epistle of 1873 was in no better temper. It attributed Masonry to Satan, and declared the evil one founded it, and contrived its development. These fierce denunciations of Pius IX are of peculiar interest to Masons because the records of the Italian Grand Lodge show His Infallible Holiness to have been expelled from the fraternity after his election as Pope. Victor Emmanuel, having been aided by Garibaldi, a 33rd degree Mason, in overthrowing the temporal power of the papacy and establishing religious and constitutional liberty in Italy, was informed that the Pope, when a young man, had been initiated, passed, and raised in a Masonic lodge. He therefore caused him to be tried for repeated violations of his obligations to the Masonic brethren. Pius IX was found guilty, expelled, and the proclamation of his expulsion signed by Victor Emmanuel, the King of Italy and Grand Master of Masons in that country, was sent all over the Masonic world. The encyclical Humanus Genus of 1884 declared that the Masonic order sought to overthrow the Church of God, which, in sane desire, was recognized by the Pope as the quenchless hate and thirst for revenge of Satan against God. The immediate effect of this was to convince the credulous that Masonry was devil worship, and Leo's accusation was given a tinge of excuse by the extraordinary action of the Masonic Grand Orient of Paris a short time before. That adventurous body removed from its conditions of membership belief in God and in immortality, an act of such gross infidelity to the first principles and fundamental laws of Freemasonry the world over, that the justly indignant Masonic authorities in the other countries at once sundered all relations with the recreant and degenerate French organization. In 1890, and again in 1892, Leo XIII issued additional exhortations against Masonry as an organization waging war against both religion and civilization. Naturally, these expressions from the head of the Catholicism were echoed by inferior authorities in that church. The Bishop of Malta, in Discourse on Malta Lodge, 1843, remarked, quote, "We with anguish at heart heard long ago of the creation of this diabolical lodge, this pestilential pulpit of iniquity and error. Flee as from the face of a venomous serpent this society, the common sewer of all filth, endeavoring through continually in vain to vomit forth the things of hell against the immaculate purity of the holy Catholic religion," end quote. The Catholic World, perhaps the leading literary magazine published by the Church in America in 1875, spoke of the quote-unquote hideous loathsomeness of this vile association. 6 years later, it said that Freemasonry as a secret society is dangerous to our free institutions. As a craft, it is obnoxious to the true spirit of humanity. No one can seriously question that the Catholic Church is prohibiting her children from becoming members of such secret organizations, has deserved well of the country, and in this one respect particularly, has done much more for the preservation of our public institutions, end quote. In 1893, it declared that the secret society is the deadliest enemy to religion and social order, end quote. These sweeping and bitter attacks upon the character and influence of Freemasonry by the authorities of the Roman Catholic Church, along with many others from the same source, too numerous and lengthy to quote or even summarize here, have had the effect on Masons which might naturally be expected. Almost without exception, their attitude toward the Church of Rome is that of enmity. When a Mason becomes a Catholic, he renounces the order. And when a Catholic becomes a Mason, he is excommunicated from the Church. That has been the condition of the affairs between Masonry and Roman Catholicism from the days of the foul, unspeakable Inquisition. So, some general commentary here on parts 1 and 2. You know, part 1 really talks about the mysteries, and some of what's described there you can find in there's a book by Manly Hall, it's a small book, it's a play on the Mysteries, the Dionysian Mysteries, the Mysteries of Eleusis. You can get that at the Philosophical Research Society in Los Angeles, California. They have a website, and we'll put that in the show notes. But that first part is probably the shortest part of this entire lengthy article, which has more than 20 parts, I believe. Part 2 is what we just read, the lengthier part of Freemasonry and some of its struggles there with the Catholic religion. And what I do find interesting is that this last line, you know, this paper written in 1913, and it says that it has been the condition of affairs between Masonry and the Roman Catholicism from the days of the foul, unspeakable Inquisition. Now, I know lots of Catholics who are Freemasons today, and I know lots of Freemasons that have no problem going to their church and being upfront about their Masonic values and, you know, and how much they love the fraternity. There's been a lot that's changed since this time, and I think perception has generally changed as well, particularly in the last 20 to 30 years. But nonetheless, we have so many people out there today who will say, well, if you go to church, you can't be a Freemason. Well, that's not true, actually, at all. And if you're a Catholic, you can't be a Freemason. And that also is just not true at all. Something else I think for the listener of the show, for some additional context on the values between your church, the Christian faith, and Freemasonry, Todd E. Creason from the Midnight Freemasons actually wrote a wonderful piece about these two things. Can you be a Christian and a Freemason, kind of an article? And we'll link that in the show notes too, because I think that is a wonderful piece to add some color to what we just read here in part two. Now let's take a break and hear from illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison.
On a crisp spring Sunday, April 9, 1865, defeated Confederate General Robert E. Lee met with Union Commander Ulysses S. Grant to surrender the Army of Northern Virginia. The occasion effectively ended the bloody American Civil War. After 4 long years, the troops, North and South, could return home to rebuild their lives. The death and destruction were over. Almost. Born in Ireland on Christmas Day, 1832, Thomas Alfred Smythe emigrated to Philadelphia at the age of 22. He was a woodworker and carriage maker by trade. At the onset of the Civil War, Smythe enlisted in the Union Army as a captain. He was quickly commissioned as a major, and after distinguishing himself in several battles, promoted to lieutenant colonel, then full colonel. He commanded troops at Chancellorsville, Gettysburg, and the siege of Petersburg, where he was promoted to brigadier general. Smythe was raised a master mason on March 6, 1865, as a member of Washington Lodge No. 1 of Wilmington, Delaware. Increasingly distinguishing himself, Smythe became commander of a division of the famed Gibraltar Brigade, so named to signify its tenacity in combat and its steadfastness like the Rock of Gibraltar. On April 7, 1865, a Confederate soldier spied Smythe in his general's uniform, which made him an appealing target. The sniper's shot shattered Brother Smythe's cervical vertebra, paralyzing him. Troops moved the wounded general to a local tavern to care for him. 2 days later, as Grant and Lee sat signing documents just 30 miles away, General Smythe passed to that house not made by hands, eternal in the heavens. Having been a master mason a mere 33 days, Brother Smythe had the unfortunate distinction of being the last Union general to lose his life in that awful conflict. For the Whence Came You podcast, this is Steve Harrison with the Masonic Minute.
All right, many thanks to illustrious Brother Harrison for his continued efforts and work here. Really enjoyed this one. What a sad tale. A master mason just 33 days. Symbolic? Little serendipity, Masonic serendipity there. But how tragic, you know, the last person lost. A master mason just having been raised not too long ago. pretty incredible story. If you like these kinds of bits of history, these interesting tales, please check out the YouTube channel, Whence Came You, or you can check out Steve Harrison's channel as well, and watch the videos that Steve makes for these segments. They have some additional artwork and some images that help you kind of go through the story and really feel it, as if you can't already with Brother Steve narrating it for you. Also, if you enjoy those, please head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on the bookstore, and check out the books by the people who have been on this show, and my book recommendations, and other recommendations by different people who have come on the show. But most importantly, check out Steve Harrison's books. Steve has a wealth of information in his books. I would consider the books he's done, like Tales from the Craft, Freemasonry at Oak Island, among some of my favorites because I like the history and the tales that he tells. But if you want some earth-shattering, really wild and cool stuff to get additional context on the history of Freemasonry here in the United States, then you want to check out Ravi Denslow's work. And Steve Harrison was the editor of these journals. You can check those out at molar.org. That's the Missouri Lodge of Research. Links to that will be in the show notes for you all. If you join that lodge, then you get those books. If you are like me and you also like to read on a Kindle electronically, searchable, pretty cool, then check out the Ray V. Denslow Volume 1 and 2 on Kindle. I think it's only 10 bucks, so you'll want to do that also. All right, now that we've had that intermission, let's read Part 3 of The Story of Freemasonry by W.G. Sibley. Now, this one is pretty interesting because we talked about the Catholic Church a little bit and the struggles that the fraternity has had with the church and the church has had with the fraternity. Now we change directions and talk about Leo Taxil's remarkable books about murder, the devil, women, and black mass in the high degrees. That's right. Oftentimes, the whole expose on Freemasonry that, you know, maybe you're online, maybe you have a Masonic account somewhere, and somebody decides to give you the business about how you're a devil-worshipping Freemason. Well, this is all thanks to Leo Taxil and their hoax, and here's why it's a hoax. Part 3 really outlines that from what I can tell and from what I've typeset. The most absurd of all of the entanglements into which the Roman Catholic Church has been drawn by its detestation for the society, a tale of ludicrous credulity and blind fanaticism unparalleled in the closing decade of the last century, has been related, with much particularity, by several writers. Gabriel Jagan Pages was born at Marseille, France, in 1854, fortunate in educational advantages during youth. On arriving at manhood, he adopted journalism as his avocation. Talented, audacious, and holding both religion and decency in contempt, his writings attracted so much attention that he sought a larger field in Paris, where he published an infidel daily paper and wrote many irreligious books that obtained a wide circulation. One of them was a scandalous work entitled The Secret Amours of Pius IX, for the publication of which he was heavily fined. In 1885, this reckless young man saw in Leo XIII's humanist genius a field for both revenue and the humiliation of the Roman Catholic Church, which he most heartily despised. He pretended conversion, suppressed his skeptical books, and was absolved by the papal nuncio in Paris from a number of excommunications recorded against him. With ardor born of desire for money and ambition to dupe the church, which had received him into its fold, he produced under the pseudonym of Leo Taxil a series of books called Complete Revelations of French Masonry, which attracted great attention in Europe, were translated into German, Italian, and Spanish, and were read by hundreds of thousands of people. In 1881, he had been made an entered apprentice, but was soon after expelled from the fraternity because of indiscretions of which he was guilty. With reckless disregard for facts and unrestrained by his ignorance of Masonry, he gave his extraordinary image, imaginative powers, full play. And with a fecundity of detail and illustration truly remarkable, represented the rites of the craft to be a hideous form of devil worship. One entire volume he devoted to female Masons, on which impossible foundation he constructed a shameful edifice of fiction full of shockingly scandalous and beastly fabrications that were received with delight by the papal authorities, who saw in them perfect justification for the attitude of their church toward Masonry. Another one of his books, of which 200,000 copies were sold at 24 francs a copy, charged every Mason with being a murderer in the spirit, if not in fact. The following translation of a passage from it explains the grounds upon which the charge was made. Quote, "Before a man is admitted to the higher degrees, he is blindfolded and taken into a room where a live sheep is lying on the floor. That animal's mouth and feet are secured, and it's clean shaven, so that its skin feels to the touch like that of a human being. Next to the animal, a man is placed, who breathes heavily, feigning to struggle against imaginary enemies. The candidate is given to understand that the sheep's body is that of a disloyal Mason who gave away the secrets of the order and must die. According to some ancient law, the candidate being made executioner as a warning to him. Then he is given a big knife and after some ceremonial is persuaded to kill the traitor. That is, plunge the knife repeatedly into the body of the sheep, which he imagines to be that of the unknown human being, his brother. Thus, every Mason is a murderer in spirit at least, if not actually, for sometimes treacherous Masons take the place of the animal." End quote. This story drew forth denials from such distinguished Freemasons as Bismarck, the Prince of Wales, and Emperor William I, which served greatly to stimulate the sale of the work. Invigorated by credulity of his victims, Taxol added spiritualism to his schedule of Masonic practices and beliefs, and told of tables floating in the air and turning into crocodiles at Masonic meetings, and for his supposed revelations was honored by Pope Leo XIII with the Order of the Holy Sepulchre, a distinguished mark of the high favor of the Roman hierarchy. High-grade Masonry was one of the most fertile fields of Taxol's grotesque falsifications. He made Charleston, South Carolina, the scene of his Luciferian Masonry because it was the home of Albert Pike, whose labors as Grand Commander of the Southern Supreme Council for the perfection of the rituals and ceremonials of the Scottish Rite have been excelled by no man. Taxol declared that in the solemn recesses of the consistory at Charleston, his satanic majesty exhibited himself without disguise, hoof, horns, tail, and all, in the exemplification of the high grades. A high priestess of this Luciferian Masonry was needed, and adroitly contrived for the consternation of the Pope and the public in the person of Diana Vaughan. She was said to be the direct descendant of a man whose embraces the lavishness Venus Astarte submitted, and whose life had been extended 33 years for the propagation of demonical designs. As a girl, she betrothed herself to the demon Asmodeus, afterwards appeared before Satan in Charleston, and was by him consecrated as his Masonic High Priestess. In the presence of Albert Pike, she possessed supernatural powers such as the ability to turn herself into liquid and pass through a stone wall, and was a very terrible personage indeed. All these and scores of other absurdities were published month after month in Paris and read with avidity in the Vatican. When the Roman ecclesiastical authorities had been sufficiently horrified by Diana Vaughan's deviltry, Taxol caused her to be quote-unquote converted, as he himself had been. This astounding change in heart, familiar with wickedness, was alleged to have been caused by Albert Pike ordering her to split upon and stab a consecrated host in one of the Masonic rites, and to utter repulsive blasphemies, deeds which would stir deep resentment in the Pope's breast. Diana refused to comply, repented, and wrote a book which was sent to Leo XIII in 1895, who, by his secretary, Mr. Vincenzo Sardi, wrote a letter thanking her and urging her to continue in her good work against Freemasonry. One extract in which Diana describes a Masonic black mass, one of scores of tales equally preposterous, may be made from this volume. Quote, "In a thick cloud of perfumes, the priest ascends the altar of Satan's synagogue. On the table is seen a goat with a human face, already excited by some preliminary homages, intoxicated by perfumes and adoration. The priest opens a box and takes out some wafers. The rites performed and the words spoken during the continuance of the magical ceremony are blasphemous in character, and the sacred vessel and its contents are subjected to insult and mockery. The goat plays the infernal part, cursing, and reviling, and lastly the following incantation is delivered. Master of Esclandres, dispenser of the benefits of crime, intendant of sumptuous sins and great vices, sovereign of contempt, preserver of old hatreds, and inspirer of vengeance and misdeeds. At this ceremony, the children of the choir are clad in red and wear scarlet caps surmounted by two horns. They hold black candles in their hands. End quote. Largely, as a result of Leo Taxil's voluminous works, one of which has 2,000 pages, the Vatican and its priesthood thought throughout Europe were aroused to a sense of impending dangers from the fraternity, and an anti-Masonic Congress was called to meet at Trent in September of 1896, to which Leo XIII telegraphed his blessing. Its purpose was to, quote-unquote, make known to everybody the immense moral and material evil done by Freemasonry to the Church and to the society, and to seek a remedy by way of a permanent international organization against the craft, end quote. 1,000 delegates from European countries attended, among them being 36 Roman Catholic bishops who found a safe retreat in the marble cathedral of the Austrian city where Masonic lodges are unknown owing to governmental prohibition, as is also the case in Russia and Poland. Gabriel Jogan Pages, better known as Leo Taxil, was the hero of the occasion, but his presence did not completely satisfy the Congress. Diana Vaughan, who for reasons obvious to Taxil alone could not appear, was greatly desired, as a suspicion that she was a myth had developed in the public press. The Congress, not entirely convinced by the plausible excuses of Taxil, entrusted an investigation of her, unable to secure proof of her existence. The pressure on Monsieur Jogan Pages finally became so strong that he announced she would appear in the hall of the Geographical Society in Paris on Easter Monday, April 19th, 1897. On that date, and at that place, the precious scamp, who had so long revealed in the admiration and confidence of the princes and priests of Catholicism, took the platform in the presence of a large audience that had assembled to see her and hear Diana Vaughan, formerly the intimate associate of the devil, now the repentant accuser of Masonry. He made a speech of superb audacity in which he told his shocked hearers that his conversation 12 years before was pretense, that Diana Vaughan was a myth, and that his revelations of Freemasonry were all deliberate lies put forth for the sole purpose of playing upon the credulity of the Roman Catholic Church and making its rulers ridiculous in the eyes of intelligent men. He added that the Bishop of Charleston had long ago assured the Pope of the falsity of his stories about Albert Pike, and that the Apostolic Vicar of Gibraltar had informed Leo XIII that the alleged caves at the place in which he had represented the Masons as engaged in foul and atrocious rites did not exist. In his chagrin, the Pope had since kept silence. This awakened the stunned audience, whose curses, howls, and threats compelled Monsieur Jogan Pages to seek security in another quarter under the protection of the police, where no doubt the results of his darling exploits afforded him profound satisfaction. The abortive chase of 12 years under Taxil's guidance after proofs of the iniquity of Freemasonry filled the church authorities with the deepest disgust, is pleasantly indicated by a remark attributed to the Canon Mostel, in which he is represented as declaring that when hell should swallow Gabriel Jogan Pages as its filthy prey, the damned therein would bow their heads under a new degradation. Later, Taxil, in an interview, says, quote, "The public made me what I am, the arch liar of the period. For when I first commenced to write against the Masons, my object was amusement, pure and simple. The crimes laid at their door were so grotesque, so impossible, so widely exaggerated, I thought everybody would see the joke and give me credit for originating a new line of humor. But my readers wouldn't have it so. They accepted my fables as gospel truth, and the more I lied for the purpose of showing that I lied, the more convinced they became that I was a paragon of veracity." End quote. Shortly before this disturbing episode, movement originated among American Catholics, who were better informed than Rome of the character, purpose, and works of Freemasonry, and who found the ban of centuries against the fraternity a stumbling block to have it removed, at least in America. This agitation gained sufficient force to reach the Vatican, but was ineffective. The Church's history in relation to Freemasonry being wholly inimical to the establishment of harmony between the two organizations, although a disappointment to many in the Roman Church, perhaps 'tis better thus. Quote, "For never can true reconcilement grow when words of deadly hate have pierced so deep." End quote. The decision of those at the top was announced in January 1895 by the Roman Catholic Archbishop of Cincinnati and included three societies beside Freemasonry in its condemnation. It instructed the ordinaries of all of the dioceses of the United States to keep the faithful away from all, and each of the three societies called the Odd Fellows, Knights of Pythias, and the Sons of Temperance. The first reason given was that these societies seem to have a decided influence to lead Catholics toward Freemasonry, and Freemasonry is under the absolute condemnation and excommunication of the Church. The Archbishop then called the attention of the Catholics to the declared and implacable hatred of Masons against the Church and all religious interests, a hatred he asserted to be openly and angrily avowed by the leading Masons of Europe and manifested by their satanic warfare against everything Christian. He admitted that this spirit did not seem to prevail in America, but because of the presence of zealous Masons in the other societies mentioned, if a Catholic is drawn into one of them, he is in continual and familiar association with the admirers of Masonry, and so exposed to imbibe their sentiments and accept their principles. Although Freemasons and some other secret fraternities are not tolerated by Catholicism, an attempt to restrain Catholics from joining the Knights of Labor, a secret organization founded by a Freemason, aroused such opposition among Catholics that it was abandoned, although it has passwords, grips, obligations, and other features that are condemned as part of Freemasonry. The Grand Army of the Republic, also organized by Freemasons and members of the other secret bodies, and largely composed of them, is not under the displeasure of the Vatican, although many zealous Freemasons hold membership in it. Whence it appears that diplomacy has a place in the diplomatic councils of Rome. Well, that's going to wrap it up for this week. I really hope you guys enjoyed this episode, and next week we're going to be back, and we're going to start off with Part 3, Section 2, where it will go into the disappearance of William Morgan and the anti-Masonic excitement which followed all over the United States, so stay tuned next week. I want to thank our producers, our fellows, our contributors one more time for all of their contributions to the show. It means the world to me and to many others who listen to the program. If you're interested in assisting the WCY podcast, head on over to our website, www.wcypodcast.com. Check out the support the show links there. You can sign up via Patreon or PayPal, and other ways you can help, you know, you can leave us a 5-star review on iTunes or any other place that you're listening to your podcast. Give us a good review, 5 stars, or even if you have a 1-star review, let me know what you think. Also, another great thing to do for us is head on over to our YouTube channel, like and subscribe our videos there. Make sure you get them and you turn on notifications so you get those as soon as we drop something new. And of course, MasonicCon Chicago, just a few weeks away at this point, so we're finalizing some things there. Look for, if you're already on our email list or you've bought a ticket, look for an email coming real soon if you haven't gotten it already. And before I close this episode out, I do have one special thanks goes out to Brother Neil Morse and Brother Michael Moran, who both shot me messages regarding last week's episode about the Illinois Enlightener magazine. So the two of these guys independently emailed me and let me know some information about these magazines, so I'll be looking into that. So I want to thank Brother Michael Moran, Brother Neil Morse for hopping on and letting me know. That's it. We'll talk to you all next week. Until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.